Coming up on this week's show, play your NES online.
Jurassic Park turns 30.
And we geek out about Street Fighter 2 with Oliver Harper.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you every Friday with our amazing friends at Bitmap Books. Now, one of my favourite books that they've done recently, The Secret History of Mac Gaming. Check out the brand new expanded edition covering the Mac as a gaming platform. Franchises like Myst, Halo, SimCity and lots more all started life on the Mac. And this incredible volume at over 480 pages long is one of their biggest, most ambitious books to date. You can check that out and the rest of their retro gaming books at bitmapbooks.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 376. Your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And a very warm welcome to our first podcast of May. Of course, a show that every week brings you up to speed on all the big happenings in the world of retro gaming and technology from over the last week. A nice little roundtable discussion in the first half of the podcast and plenty of meaty new stories to get our teeth into this week, even though I'm actually a vegetarian, but you know, we'll start with that. And then second half of the podcast is when we welcome on our very special guest. Now, oh my God, how much fun was chatting to Oliver Harper on this week's show, Joe?
Oh man, you know what? He was so fun, and it was such like an energetic, you know, interview, because he mentions it in the interview and how when he first kind of started doing his, you know, his reviews, what he's kind of famous for is his really in-depth like retrospectives of films, but then he does it with video game franchises as well, which I absolutely love. And he was saying when he first started out, he was very calm and cool and collect, you know, and maybe a little bit monotone. And I kind of like, I like that. I find his voice very relaxing because I'm a big fan of Oliver Harper. And then talking to him on the show, he was like bouncing off us, like full of energy and stuff. And I absolutely loved it. And it was, I really, really loved this chat. And obviously, you know, we spoke all about his YouTube channel and his own gaming memories and stuff, which I found hilarious. Like his kind of like his journey, you know, with like the CDI and stuff like that.
He backdoored the wrong horses, yeah, didn't he, pretty much.
Yeah, he did, which I thought was fantastic. But then we really kind of got into the meat of it, as you said earlier on, and we talked about his brand new Street Fighter 2 documentary, Here Comes a New Challenger, for about half an hour, which was just really cool. Me and Dan, very lucky to have seen the documentary, and it's absolutely fantastic, isn't it, Dan?
It is, and that's the thing. I mean, you know, Street Fighter 2, we talk about this in the interview, that really, it's often credited as the game that kind of rejuvenated the arcades. You know, you kind of think, obviously the arcade scene kind of faded off as we got into the late 90s. But, you know, there are some people that think that without Street Fighter 2, it might have actually died off a couple of years earlier. You know, that was responsible for a massive resurgence of getting people back in there. Then, of course, we had the amazing home ports as well. And, you know, the amount of friends I had who bought Super Nintendos just for Street Fighter 2. You know, there aren't many games that are like big system sellers like that. So definitely something that really changed the landscape of video games and continues to this day. I mean, you know, we talk about in the interview the amount of times we've bought new versions of Street Fighter 2 or new upgrade packs or different. I mean, it's probably up there with Sonic the Hedgehog 2 for me in terms of games that I've rebought on pretty much every console I've had for the last 30 years.
Yeah, I'll agree. I've got many different versions of Street Fighter 2, but I guess it goes hand in hand because there's so many different versions of the actual game itself. But yeah, I think I've got it on pretty much every console since the Mega Drive. I've got some sort of form of Street Fighter 2. But yeah, I mean, we even talk about like its impact it's had on pop culture. You know, the amount of people who aren't really gamers but know what Street Fighter are, or even know what you're doing when you do the classic like Hadouken kind of thing, like, they know what it is, or at least they know it's from that fighting game, you know? So, yeah.
I'm going to ask a question, Joe, because I know you love the original Mario movie. What are your thoughts on the live-action Street Fighter movie?
I like Street Fighter the movie.
I knew you would.
It's ridiculous, but I like it.
So we do touch on that, and obviously the animated movie as well that, you know, is a big fan favourite. And, yeah, just a great chat. I mean, Oliver, he's run his YouTube channel since 2011, but also in more recent years, he's got into producing, you know, proper commercial documentaries that are on, you know, services like Amazon Prime. I mean, there was In Search of the Last Action Heroes that came out a couple of years ago. And this, a massive new 2.5-hour epic, beautifully produced love letter to Street Fighter 2. It's called Here Comes a New Challenger, and it is available now on Blu-ray, and it's going to be coming to streaming services hopefully very soon as well. So if you're a big fan of Street Fighter 2, you can't miss out on this. A proper geek out with our guest, Oliver Harper. He'll be on the show in around half an hour from now. Now, speaking of geeking out, I mean, God, over the weekend, how much fun was Friday night?
Oh, yeah, it was absolutely amazing. We did a... We changed the date or the day of our Patreon hangout, didn't we? We experimented to try it on a Friday because we get a lot of comments saying Sunday's difficult, which, you know, is understandable. It's kind of like the last night of the weekend. People have got work in the morning, yeah, and people have got kids, family, you know, family people and stuff like that. We tried a Friday night and we were a bit worried, you know, that, you know, a few of the familiar faces wouldn't make it and it'd be a bit of a quieter one, but really happy to report that, you know, a lot of our like frequent backers and, you know, people who join us a lot were all present, and we did get a nice amount of new people on there who said they'd never been able to make the Sunday, and quite a few Americans on there, which was really cool, wasn't it?
I think the time worked out better for the Americans actually, because Friday, you know, you can stay up a little bit later and do stuff. So that was really interesting to see. And I think it might be a plan to kind of maybe alternate them in the future to try and hit different audiences and stuff, because it's one thing, you know, having an international audience, you know, it all comes out on a Friday, everyone knows that, but people are listening at different times in different time zones and stuff. Really interesting talk as well. We covered a lot of things in there.
Yeah, I mean, we always do. It's just a proper, you know, all get together, reminisce, chuff systems, new pickups and all that. So if you haven't joined us for the Patrons Hangout before, now would be a very good time to sign up, and you will get an invite to the May Patrons Hangout that is coming up at the end of the month. And also, you can check out, if you join us as a Gold Tier member or above, our bonus podcast. Now, we do an extra podcast every single month. I think we're on like episode 36 of that now, the Retro Hour After Hours. And this time we talked about multiplayer games. Now, this was a fun episode to do.
It was originally meant to be co-op, but Dan changed it. But you know what? It worked well, actually, because a lot of the games that had multiplayer options also had co-op. And it's interesting, that kind of couch co-op thing that was missing from gaming for a long time when online happened. I remember at one point having a console where I couldn't actually do any couch co-op stuff. It all had to be done online. So it's nice seeing that kind of local multiplayer come back, and it's happened with a lot of new indie titles as well, which is also what we kind of had in the mix.
Yeah, so if you join us on Patreon right now, you're going to unlock all of those previous episodes. And we'd like to welcome in some new members on Patreon this week as well. It's actually been a pretty decent week, I think. The best one in quite a while. So let's induct our new members into the Retro Hour Hall of Fame.
Hall of Fame!
And a massive thank you to Greg Gavitus,
Chris S,
Jeff Schapp,
and Ratty Allen, who all joined us over the last week. We massively appreciate your support. And if you'd like to get in there as well and join our patrons community, all the details are at theretrohour.com. Right then, let's hop into this week's news stories. And I must admit, quite often doing this podcast, things make me feel very old. This one, though, really hit home. That Jurassic Park celebrates its 30th anniversary next month. Now, that was a movie that, I mean, I don't know about you guys, but for me, it was probably the first film that I really remember just being totally obsessed with at the cinema. I think that some of that came out, I probably went to see Jurassic Park with different friends and relatives about six times.
Yeah, there's certain films that you go to the cinema to see repeatedly, like when they're out, because they're just so good. And Jurassic Park was definitely one. I think Lion King was also another one when I was younger. But
For me, interestingly, Jurassic Park was the first ever film I saw at cinema. So that's making me feel old as well.
You know, I remember going with my mum, because I'd, you know, me and my brother had told her how good it was. We'd gone with friends and our aunties and uncles and stuff. And my mum, she doesn't take scary films all that well, but, you know, she liked the idea of it. She liked Steven Spielberg movies. So we came along, and I remember a few of my friends from school was sat about three rows in front of us, and my mum's there sitting between me and my brother. And you know the scene when the raptors are trying to get in the room, aren't they? And they're trying the door handles, then they get in. She screamed at the loudest you've ever heard, dug her fingernails into my arm. She was holding that hard. And like literally my friends just burst out laughing. I got ripped at school for that for weeks.
Well, I remember people like taking like 7-year-old kids in, like, you like dinosaurs, don't you? And watching them come out like absolutely mortified, like just, you know, all the blood's gone from their face.
Yeah, I mean, incredible movie, and obviously they're still making them today, but I think nothing really compares to that first Jurassic Park film in terms of cinematic experiences and just, you know, a true classic. And the special effects, I mean, you watch it today, I've got it on, you know, Blu-ray, still look incredible.
Yeah, it was really well done.
Yeah, using those Silicon Graphics workstations that, of course, appear in the movie as well. And like anything that's that big, there was obviously a lot of spin-offs, including lots of video games. And it turns out, to honour 3 decades of Jurassic Park, there is a new collection of Jurassic Park retro games from our good pals at Limited Run.
Yeah, so this is doing the rounds everywhere. Like, I've seen it. It's, you know, it's even made it to the Metro, which is, you know, kind of news outlet for the UK, a big one. They're going to be, they've not kind of like done the full details of it yet or anything like that, but it's just coming over summer. They're going to be doing a huge release to celebrate Jurassic Park's 30th anniversary. And in the picture they've released, they've not confirmed what games are going to be in it, but it's probably going to be these games because they're in the picture they've posted, which it's quite funny. It's Samuel L. Jackson's character, the spoiler alert, the one who gets his arm ripped off by the Velociraptors, with his arm missing, the Velociraptor there in toy form. And he's in front of a collage of Jurassic Park games. So what's interesting about it, which me and Ravi were kind of talking about before, which we're both, I think this is really cool, but disappointed to see, it's only the Nintendo releases.
It's a weird thing, like Jurassic Park. So every single game that got released for Jurassic Park, I think, was different. And I don't know a franchise that had that much kind of variations in, you know, the game for that title. Mm. It would usually just be a port from one to the other. But they were very notably different. Like, and you are mentioning there's not versions there. The Mega Drive version was very different to the Super Nintendo, but also the Amiga version, which was the one that I played and loved, was also pretty different as well. So
they were made by different companies though, weren't they? I think that the Sega version was actually made in-house by Sega, and the Super Nintendo version and the Amiga versions were both made by Ocean, weren't they, if I remember correctly?
So
which could explain the variance.
The Amiga version, I always saw that as, like, Ravi was telling me about it earlier on. And it kind of jogged my memory. It was like the better version of the Super Nintendo version, wasn't
it? Yeah, so the Super Nintendo one seemed a bit zoomed in, where the Amiga version was like, it's probably one of the nicest looking games for the Amiga, I think. And there's also differences with like the first person shooter section, because that was the thing. It had an above view, you know, you're walking around solving puzzles and stuff. But then it had this like Alien versus Predator kind of simple first-person shooter section, which is pretty amazing as well for a game at that time.
Yeah. You're thinking of 93, that was a year of Doom, wasn't it? So, I mean, the FPS genre was just blowing up then. So it made sense that, you know, if they want to have a massive hit, you know, to kind of get something of Doom in there, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it was Doom fever, wasn't it? And it's just funny that I would have loved to have been like, you know, kind of like in the briefing for that, like, right, we need to make a Jurassic Park game. We want it as a top-down shooter for the Super Nintendo. So you play as Professor Grant, you're shooting Velociraptors and stuff. But when you go in a building, we want it to look like Doom.
Yeah.
Like, right, okay, kind of thing. But yeah, as we said, there's the Super Nintendo version in this picture. There's the NES version. Then there's the Game Boy version. But then also, there was a part two to Jurassic Park games for the Super Nintendo called The Chaos Continues. So this wasn't based on The Lost World. This was just a second Jurassic Park game, because obviously Jurassic Park was huge. So you get The Chaos Continues for the SNES, and then you also get Part 2, The Chaos Continues, for the Game Boy. Now, I don't know if you guys have played these ones, but they're more a run-along shooter, kind of like in the vein of Contra. You know,
kind of side-scrolling.
Side-scroller platform shooter. Yeah. They were quite tough, if I remember rightly, because I've not played them in a long time. But as Ravi said, you know, the Mega Drive version for me was just so iconic. Like,
there's also the construction management building sim one.
Oh, yeah. PC,
which was that, like, Jurassic Park, I think it was Operation Genesis, where it was, it was like a kind of SimCity-style one as well. So that's not included.
Yeah.
And then they still make those now, don't they? The latest Jurassic Park games are like that.
Yeah, like Jurassic World ones.
Yeah.
So they do a lot of fun. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting that it just seems to be the Nintendo releases. But I think, yeah, it's probably going to be a bit of an ask because it was that many different ports. Mm. To that many different home systems, you know, that I guess they can't please everyone. And, you know, the thing with Limited Run as well is, I mean, we haven't got full details on this yet, but generally they put them out as physical.
Yeah, they do.
And it makes sense. This is going to be a physical pack. So imagine if they had to put the Amiga version and the God, whatever else, 3DO version, all that in there as well. It's going to be a massive effort to get all
get
those
that,
printed up. And
Tiger Electronics version in there as well. Yeah.
But yeah, it is a nice little celebration of 30 years of Jurassic Park, which is just nuts. So we'll keep an eye on that. Should be available. I think the movie celebrates its anniversary next month in June. So I'd expect to see a bit more news around then, hopefully. So we'll keep you posted. Now, this is something I was very surprised to see. And I think we're talking about this actually on the After Hours podcast, our bonus patrons podcast that we do, when we're talking about multiplayer games, that it is very cool when you get a chance to play your retro systems online, usually via emulation these days. You know, I've played some Amiga games online with my brother, you know, using online services that kind of tricks him into thinking it's, you know, a couch co-op game, but you're playing it over the net. However, this one is a new game for the Nintendo Entertainment System that actually you can play via the internet on your original NES hardware.
Well, you should know about this one, Dan, because you've just done a video on playing stuff on the Amiga CD32 using one of these little Wi-Fi chips.
I watched YouTube on my Amiga CD32 using one of these little chips.
And getting online, didn't you?
Yeah. Oh, that's the thing. I mean, these small little Wi-Fi chips are, you know, they're very inexpensive. You can get them off Amazon for like £3 each. So, I mean, in terms of technology, they're very affordable. And it makes sense that someone would do this. But I think here, the really impressive thing is actually coding a game that runs on the original NES and enabling that Wi-Fi chip in the cartridge to connect to an online service. Now, this is a game called Super Tilt Bro, which could be possibly inspired by another game that's got a similar kind of name, do you think, Joe?
Yeah, just a little bit. I mean, it plays like Super Smash Bros, from what I can see, and it features characters from the studio's other games that are making this game. So it's being made by a homebrewing studio, which are called Broke Studio. And it uses the fighters, you know, like in Smash Bros, like from different franchises, from games they've already made, if that makes sense. So it's like bringing that
ones
franchise.
That they own.
Yeah, ones that they own. And as Ravi says, and you say, it features the electronic board in there, the Wi-Fi chipset, so you can bring it online. And it does give you that local, you do get local gameplay as well as the online. But I don't know, the NES online. I mean, obviously it's not the NES online, it's the game is online. So it's not making the Nintendo online, it's the game that's online, I guess, is what's happening. But
well, you're still playing the game online though, aren't you? Via the Nintendo. It is.
Yeah,
I mean, to me this is no different from, you know, when you used to add a Wi-Fi connector onto, you know, via USB onto your Xbox 360.
Yeah.
It's just a hardware Wi-Fi chip.
Yeah, true. I guess, you know, you're not wrong in that sense. Like, you know, it is cool, and I'm like looking forward to seeing this. So, you know, it comes out in April 2024, and it's currently on Kickstarter, but it's absolutely smashed its goal of 35,000. It's currently on 60,000 at the point of recording this, with like 23 days left to go. So by the time this comes out, it'll be about 18 days on there, because we're recording a little bit early. So yeah, I mean, maybe this is the future for Nintendo.
It's
online.
Interesting, because I can imagine it's not going to take up much bandwidth. Like,
no,
it's not going to be like high demand. What they're kind
of not going to max out your 1 gigabit fiber connection, Rev.
No, and I'm hoping that it's not got like a central server, that there's a way to connect to other people just directly, or a way for people to host their own servers, so that if there is a central server, it doesn't go offline like on these big ones. Or if there is one, they build it up and they add other games in there and stuff. Maybe you'll start to get like avatars on the odd NES, like your Mii's or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they are saying, I'm not too sure how this all works and stuff, but they are saying there is going to be a netcode feature on there as well, to kind of like, it says it's a rollback netcode to ensure there's as little disturbance as possible.
I think that's a kind of like a buffering thing.
Oh,
so
okay.
Fair basically, enough. Where if your connection goes down, then it's not going to cut.
Oh, okay, cool.
So it's going to have like a little bit of a buffer. That's my guess.
Imagine looking at this though, because I mean, one good thing about it is it's open source, this game.
Mm.
So it doesn't mean that people, you know, will be able to modify it if the servers went down, for example. But it does have matchmaking and matchmaking queues and, you know, stuff like that with other players around the world. So I imagine for that to work, for it to discover other players, it must be some kind of central server, I'd guess. But, you know, the fact that they're doing, making it open source would mean that if their servers ever do go offline, that it will be easy for someone to modify it and change it, I guess.
Yeah.
But it's a very cool idea, and it just makes you think. I mean, you know, it uses the ESP8266 Wi-Fi chipset and an FPGA, which, you know, in terms of cost, if you're manufacturing these, only adds a couple of pounds, a couple of dollars on, you know, it's not that much. And I think it's a very interesting concept, and it kind of feels like to me like there might be more of these coming out soon, because it makes sense now with the affordability of that, you know, to people to implement these kind of online modes as well onto.
Yeah, I guess if it's that cheap and, you know, people have done it, it could go onto other systems. You know, you could have an EverDrive that actually had one, and that could be really useful. You know, it's an interesting concept, and I'm glad that we've kind of got to the point that Wi-Fi is this cheap that you can actually just put it inside a cart for the games.
Yeah, that is nuts, isn't it? So it does look very, very cool. It is still running on Kickstarter when the show comes out. So if you want to back that, I'll link it up in our show notes along with the rest of the stories. Now, this was quite a, I must admit, quite a surprising headline to see this week. Netflix is going to be shutting down its DVD rental business in September this year. Now, to me, that was surprising because I assume they shut that down about 10 years ago, if I'm honest.
Oh, no, they've still been running that, and they've been running it in America only.
Right.
So I actually went on the website a while ago, but I had to use a VPN to get on there. And
is that the DVD.com, is it, their the website they've
been running? Kind of like Netflix.com, I think, /DVD or something. But it will only work if you're in America. Now, I think the reasoning for this in America is because the internet in certain regions was just so bad that it made sense. You know, there wasn't the massive, like, we have 4G coverage all over the country. You know, there's spots in America, there's lots of people on different networks. But also with something like Starlink coming up now, a lot of the rural places that didn't have the internet have now managed to get it. And also, to be honest, it's probably going to be cheaper to go out and buy a DVD for 50p, then actually rent one and get it sent to your house and all of that at the moment. I think it was a necessity, though. Remember, America's a place where they've still got the last Blockbuster. So there's still a kind of demand for older media and stuff. Like when I went there, I was amazed to go and find some video stores that were still running. And even when I went 2 years ago, there was a lot of places that I asked for about UHD DVDs, and they didn't know what the hell I was on about. So, you know, it takes longer to roll out something in such a big country.
Well, because I remember signing up to, because I don't think I ever used Netflix DVD rental service over here. I think I signed up to Love Film, if you guys remember that.
Yeah.
Like a competitor to Netflix. And I do remember getting them in the post because, I, you know, when you went to Blockbuster, if you didn't get it back, like, you know, within 24 hours, you'd get a fine. And the amount of times I did that at university and stuff, you know, we'd rent it out and like, has anyone took the video back yet? Oh, no, it's still on the side. Well, the one we rented 2 weeks ago. And, you know, those late fees were just ridiculous. I think when stuff like this came along and you could kind of, you know, you could keep it as long as you want, you just put it back in the post. It was a free post as well. It did just completely change the whole model before the internet came along and streaming became affordable. Although one thing I do kind of miss about it, and I mean, you know, I still do buy DVDs and Blu-rays occasionally, particularly if it's a movie that I really want to keep. Because I mean, they just vanish off streaming services so regularly.
Yeah.
And you know, you'll see something on there, but oh, I'll watch it next week, then it's gone.
Well, that's the thing. You know, streaming services don't have all the DVDs, and even a lot of them haven't kind of hit the conversion yet. So, you know, often I'm searching for odd movies and stuff like that, and I'll find a DVD rip more than I'll find, you know, something available on the streaming service of that movie. And it's often like the niche stuff and, you know, like the kind of an odd sci-fi film from the 90s or something that they just don't have on streaming.
I guess the point is, though, that the selection that's offered by most streaming services is enough for most people. they're always going to find something there, you know, that will satisfy them to watch for an hour or two of an evening on there. So, you know, people aren't going out of the way to buy DVDs and stuff anymore. I was reading this article, though, on Engadget, and I'll link it in our show notes as well. And they talk about a service called Redbox. And I was trying to remember because when I lived in Leeds, probably around 2005, I lived in a place called Headingley, which was like, you know, where all the students basically live because it's right near the university. And I remember briefly a DVD vending machine popping up just in the middle of like the shopping area there. And you could go at like 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, scan your bank card, or, you know, put your bank card in, put your code, PIN number in, and you could rent like basically DVDs via this vending machine.
We had that, but it was just a dude with a big wallet. That would be like selling DVDs.
Inside the vending machine, But I remember thinking that was very cool. Because, I mean, I could literally, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, when you're in your early 20s and you're up all night with your mates, like, oh, let's go rent a film.
To be honest, the more and more we're talking about it, the more and more I want a service like this in the UK, because signing up for streaming is incredibly expensive, like all of the platforms. And sometimes I find that, you know, there'll be something that I really want to watch, but it's on like Apple TV or it's on some other service, and it gets so frustrating because you're kind of stuck behind this like barrier where something like this would be fun. Just getting something physically and putting it in. But obviously it just doesn't seem to be viable these days, but there might be a nostalgic DVD renting service or something. We should do it, guys. The Retro Hour DVD.
Retro Hour DVD.
Yeah, I've probably got enough of them in my living room.
Same.
But yeah, I mean, you're right. Cause I do remember there was that big movement probably around 10, 15 years ago. In America, they called it the cord cutters movement, didn't they? Because, you know, satellite or cable bills were too expensive. So instead, we'll go with online services. And now, God, the amount of ones I sign up to, we pay way more for these subscription services than we ever did for Sky or Virgin Media.
Yeah, if you stacked up all of the services and you paid for them, you'd be getting into hundreds and hundreds of pounds. And also now they're on different tiers as well. So even looking at Netflix, you know, you're paying more for 4K as well.
But yeah, so it is. If you've been renting DVDs from Netflix, it looks like the end of an era in September this year. Apparently the first ever DVD they posted out was Beetlejuice.
Oh, that's so a good film.
See what the last one will be in September. So, yeah, imagine a few people want to kind of, you know, be on record as having that last ever rental. Now, this is quite cool to see. Something that's not very well loved in the retro gaming community. And I don't know if you guys have ever played it. We're talking about these Zelda games on the Philips CDI. Now, there's a couple on there. There was Faces of Evil and Wand of Gamelon. And then there was Zelda's Adventure. They came out a couple of years later as well. Generally not well remembered because they were dreadful games. Now, you must have at least seen videos about this, Joe. You know, you're a Zelda fan.
Yeah.
Any thoughts on those games?
Yeah, so they're kind of like, I've not got a CDI. It's one of the, you know, one of the consoles I would really like to have, but just, you know, they're still really expensive. I missed it, you know, when they went stupidly cheap for like 20 quid in the UK. They're now like really expensive again. And the Zelda games in particular are really expensive. And let's be honest, it would just be there on the shelf to say, oh, look, I have the Zelda games for the CDI. I've obviously seen the famous AVGN episode about them, which kind of brought them to my attention. I think that was like 2008. That one probably came out, that classic episode. And obviously now they're just kind of like hailed as these like terrible games and kind of like, you know, a black spot in Nintendo's legacy where they sided with Philips and rather than Sony and licensed out Zelda and Mario, and we got Hotel Mario. So, you know, but it's always fun when you see these games kind of pop up again and, you know, they've been ported to another system or, you know, available to play online all of a sudden, stuff like that. But yeah, Zelda's Adventure, of the three of them, I think it's regarded as like, I want to say the better one. Like, that's a big stretch, you know, of like... Yeah.
Considering the competition,
but it's the more, you know, well-regarded one without, you know, giving it too much praise. But this is interesting. It's been ported to the Game Boy. Now, it's got a completely different visual stylization from the CDI version, because obviously the CDI, you know, as much as it pains me to say it, much more powerful than the Game Boy. At the end,
and graphically, I don't think that game looked too bad. Actually, I think it had some quite decent graphics.
It looks like clip art, kind of.
It does look like clip art. It's, you know, that photorealistic, like, you know, kind of like sprites walking around like a real world, but it's like really bad Photoshop. That's what kind of reminds me.
For me, it's like clip art mixed with an encyclopedia and...
That
kind of vibe.
Apparently the guy that did the graphics on that, I mean, they did a lot of models. It was a guy called Jason Bakutis, and apparently he worked on movies like Critters 3 and Freddy's Dead, The Final Nightmare.
Oh, nice. I like Critters 3.
Not well regarded for its incredible visuals, Critters 3, or its high budget, but wasn't that the movie that Leonardo DiCaprio appeared in first?
Yeah, that was his first ever film. Yeah, there you go. There's your Critters 3 fact for the day. But yeah, the port of this, it's been made by a guy called John Lay, and he's ported it to Game Boy, but it adopts the Link's Awakening style. So he says he's made it in GB Studio, and he's, you know, used some mods to GB Studio, which is like a program to make Game Boy games on.
Yeah.
It looks like to me he's used the Link's Awakening game engine to recreate Zelda's Adventure, which I haven't got a problem with. I think that's really cool, and I'm all for, like, you know, new versions of Zelda, of classic Zelda games. What made me laugh about it, though, is in his video, the side comparison is how much quicker the Game Boy version is than the CDI version, like, you know, with the scrolling, like, from, like, kind of, like, frame to frame. When you go from, like, panel to panel, on the Game Boy version, it's seamless, but on the CDI version, it just takes forever to load. But he's done a really, really good job of recreating, like, the game and recreating the dungeons and everything, and obviously the little Zelda sprite and stuff like that. I think it looks really cool and, like, a real kind of, like, tasty bit of retro goodness, really.
That third game, it's got some very, very cheesy FMV scenes, and I think I was reading in one of these articles here that apparently the actress who played Zelda in the full motion video was actually the receptionist from the game company.
Brilliant.
So it wasn't, like, you know, not professional actors or anything like that. But yeah, this is the first time that I've seen, because normally, you know, we talk about demakes and generally they're for a bit of tongue in cheek that make the game a lot worse. This is the first demake I've seen that legitimately makes the game a hell of a lot better.
Yeah, 100%. Plays better, probably looks better, it's quicker, probably more enjoyable, I hate to say. But yeah, I mean, it runs on original hardware as well. So, you know, there isn't a physical release of it or anything like that. It is just a ROM that you download onto, like, your Everdrive, or you just play, you know, on your computer on an emulator. But it's available now to download. And at the point of recording, Nintendo haven't taken it down just yet. But it's one.
I don't think Nintendo want anything to do with this game. They'll probably just leave it alone.
Yeah, they might just leave it alone.
I don't remember that coming out. Yeah.
Leave it alone to stop it getting any more attention. Like, oh, that's not based on one of our games.
Yeah, I've got a feeling that's just been erased from all of their records. So it is free if you want to download it now. So I'll link that up in our show notes too. Now, this week's special guest, Oliver Harper, a proper geek out about Street Fighter 2, coming up in just a moment. Before we do that, let's give a quick mention to our incredible sponsor, our friends at ExpressVPN. Now, you know that we're big supporters of privacy, and I love this analogy with ExpressVPN. If you go to the bathroom, you know, it's only responsible that you close the door behind you. You don't want random passerbys looking in. So when you go online, it's also important that you close that virtual bathroom door, because using the internet without a VPN, you know, you're exposed to everyone then. Your internet service provider in particular can know exactly which website you visit and what you've done on there. And we've heard these stories, particularly in America, of these big ISPs that sell all that information to the big tech giants, advertising companies, and they're using all that data to target advertising specifically at you, aren't they?
Yeah, so ExpressVPN, it's awesome. You can have it straight away on your phone loading up, on your laptop. You know, I have it to auto start on my computer. And what it does is it creates a secure encrypted tunnel between your device and the internet. So your activity can't be seen by anyone. And it's really good if you're going to, like, a hotel, if you're traveling, if you're using airport Wi-Fi or, like, an unsecured network you've not been on before. It just offers that extra bit of privacy and protection.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, all you got to do is fire up ExpressVPN. One click, one button. To go back to that analogy, as easy as closing your bathroom door. So if you want to try ExpressVPN, we've got, of course, an incredible offer that you can claim right now and support the podcast by supporting our sponsors. Let them know that we sent you by going to expressvpn.com/retro, and you will get an extra 3 months for free on top of a one-year plan. So that's expressvpn.com/retro, and a massive thank you to our friends at ExpressVPN for their continued support. Right then, let's get into this week's very special guest, talking all about his incredible new Street Fighter documentary, Here Comes a New Challenger. Just some reminiscing in general about the 8 and 16-bit days, come back to the C64, and lots of failed console chat as well, and his incredible YouTube channel. Our special guest, Oliver Harper, is next on the Retro Hour podcast. You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and let's welcome on this week's very special guest. And I know we're just going to completely geek out over the next hour about all things retro, maybe a bit of movie talk as well, obviously lots of video game chat, and lots of fighting game talk, in particular Street Fighter 2. With this week's special guest, who is a YouTuber, he's a director as well, let's just say an all-round fantastic retro content creator, Oliver Harper. Welcome to the show, Oliver.
Hello, guys. Thanks for having me on the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you both.
Yeah, very nice to have you on. And obviously we're going to talk about Here Comes a New Challenger, this real love letter to Street Fighter 2, probably the most comprehensive history of Street Fighter 2 that I've ever seen. Your new film is out now. But before we get into all that, I mean, you know, we always like to kind of find out our guests' geek credentials, if you like. So, I mean, kind of going all the way back to day one, I mean, tell us your first kind of video game memory then. Where does it all kind of begin for you?
Strangely, it was actually on the NES, which wasn't, you know, a hugely popular console in the UK, down to its sort of distribution, wasn't it, at the time? Mm. It was playing, yeah, just a, my friend got the Super Mario pack with Duck Hunt, like in 1990. And that was, the first proper game I played. I mean, I must have played, like, maybe the odd arcade beforehand, perhaps something like Shadow Dancer or something like that. But it blew my mind. And then I said to my dad, I want a games console, and they bought me a Commodore 64. And
so was that the Commodore 64 console, not the
no, no, it was the computer, Commodore 64,
right? Okay.
Computer. It was the Terminator 2.
Oh, nice.
Pack. Right, so that would be 92. So it was a couple of years later, and I know I was like, oh, okay, I got a computer, but it was I really enjoyed it. I know I loved the Commodore. I, you know, played. I got all these secondhand games, like most people did, which were all kind of copied. And I got this kind of disk drive and everything through a friend, and the T2 came on a cartridge, so there was no loading, which is great. And I kind of sort of became addicted to video games, and also had to put up with the long load times, which is always frustrating. But it was they were still selling games though, C64 games. In like 92, 93. So you'd go into a shop and there'd be that little rack you'd spin around, and it'd be like Jaws on the Commodore. I found Last Ninja. I thought, get that. And that was like, oh, that blew my mind. And then it sort of moved on. My dad also randomly came home one day with a ZX Spectrum, like with tons of games.
Oh, wow.
Just, you know, just by chance, just turned up with it. Here you go, have this. I was like, oh my God. So more games to play, more loading to put up with. And that also, at that time, you know, around that period when Street Fighter 2 came out, and I sort of experienced it on the Commodore 64, and it was dreadful. But it was, I migrated onto consoles like most people did around that time. I got a Sega Mega Drive for Christmas, and having Sonic and Road Rash 2 was like mind blowing as well. And then I jumped onto the SNES, and then I had this, after the 16-bit generation, I picked consoles that did not perform well. So I migrated to the 3DO.
Sorry. You're like the first person who's ever said that. The chronological order is usually PlayStation, N64, or maybe Sega Saturn.
Yeah.
3DO.
Oh, yeah. I got the 3DO. It was a Gold Star 3DO from Special Reserve. Also, you guys must remember them.
Yes.
And that was advertised in every magazine. And it came with FIFA. And because I got the 3DO because, again, Street Fighter related, I saw Super Turbo.
Yeah.
Super Street Fighter 2 Turbo on it. And I was like, oh my God. I was like, this is arcade perfect. It looks amazing.
Yeah.
Because in Cambridge, where I lived, they had an import shop called, I think it was like Tars Video Games or whatever. And they had, you know, I saw the Neo Geo CD, I saw the 3DO, and I saw the early PlayStation there. And I think it was obviously super expensive. And, but I'd seen the 3DO with Street Fighter on it, I was like, I've got to have that. So at that point, the 3DO had kind of come down in price, and I was literally the only person in my school who had a 3DO. Mm. And then after that, I jumped onto the Sega Saturn because I loved my fighting games. And my friend had a PlayStation, and his older brother had a Saturn. I still had my 3DO. But seeing the two consoles, like, I was kind of more intrigued by the Saturn.
Yeah.
With its arcade kind of ports and stuff, and playing, seeing Guardian Heroes. And then you got Street Fighter Alpha. I was like, I've got to have this machine. I've got to jump onto that one. I don't want the PlayStation because trying to do fireballs with the PlayStation joypad just gave me horrendous crap. So yeah, got to Saturn, then went to Dreamcast, and then I kind of stopped for a bit. So yeah, so after 16-bit generation, I just kind of picked the wrong machines that didn't really stick around for long. But I loved it. I didn't care. I loved them.
It's interesting that you said the wrong machines, but if you're into arcade games, particularly fighting games, you've got X-Men Children of the Atom, Marvel vs. Capcom, you know, for Dreamcast, all those kind of pixel perfect 2D games. They were the right consoles for that, if that was what you were into. Do you know what I mean?
Oh yeah, for sure. But I suppose picked the wrong consoles. It was just mainly down to frustration of being able to find these games in an easy fashion, because Saturn was fine until the end, but when you went to Game or something in 1998, it was like the Saturn was just a tiny little section in the corner where you had Quake was out, Sonic R and Duke Nukem 3D. I got all those, but it was kind of like you ask what's coming out next and they go, oh, like Shining Force 3, that's kind of it.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh damn, you know. So yeah, that was then the Dreamcast came out, and one of the interviewees in Here Comes a New Challenger, Damien McFarren, he had the same experience as me, because he had a Saturn. We both had ours chipped to play import games. We had a 50-60 hertz switch, and we traded all our games and the console for a Dreamcast and one game when it came out in Japan. And I having a Dreamcast like first before anyone else was just like, you know, everyone wanted to pile around my house just to see it in action. And it was incredible, but it was one of those regrets I always had. And I still talk about it. It's like, I should have kept my Sega Saturn collection because I had everything. I had Deep Fear, I had Panzer Dragoon Saga, I had Radiant Silver Gun, all the games that are rare. Because I'm only kind of saying this really, because if I kept it, then I could sell it for a lot of money. That's everyone's regret, really. I should have kept that. Yeah. I could have sold that.
Those games you're just listening
to. We didn't know they were going to be worth money in the future then, did we?
I know.
Yeah, we had no idea.
You know, so if you went back in time, you go, want to go back in time, buy loads of Star Wars merchandise and just sell it in the future, you know, make a killing. But you know, that was kind of my experience with it. And during that period, I bought all the video game magazines. I was, you know, still I'd say pretty knowledgeable about video games. Also, in the case with movies as well. Hence why I'd sort of jumped onto YouTube to review films, which was kind of the same sort of passion I had with video games. But video games, you know, when I started doing it, I wasn't really a thing of mine to sort of like, hey, I'm going to talk about video games. It was just more about, I found movies kind of more interesting to discuss at that point.
Yeah, that was going to be our next question. So our next question was really, you know, were you a gamer first before kind of like, I wouldn't say a film critic, because obviously I guess when you're a child, you're not necessarily a film critic, but I guess for you, were you more interested in film than you were games? Because obviously you initially kind of started with film when you started your YouTube channel.
Yeah, for sure. I was definitely more into video games and talking about them. Mm. And it was definitely more of a social thing as well, to have your friends come around and play video games. But of course I love films. I was obsessed with Star Wars and the Superman films. I think for every British child of our sort of generation, like Bank Holiday Mondays, Christmas time, Easter, there's always going to be the big movies are always on, right? And you always want to sit and watch them. But there's always a Star Wars film on, there'll be a Bond film, there'll be a Superman film every kind of seasonal sort of holiday. Mm. So that was kind of my youth of kind of being obsessed with the TV guide and finding what's going to be on and taping them. I wasn't really obsessed about the making of the movies until I sort of became like into my late teens and started doing sort of film studies. It was kind of media studies at the time in like Cambridge, where they had better facilities than some of the other more expensive sixth form colleges. But yeah, I was learning, you know, like to put movies on Super VHS and trying to edit that. It was a nightmare. And then we got the first digital camera came in, and using Final Cut Pro, the first version of it, that was just like made everything super easy. But then I, you know, at the same time, I was working at Game, you know, in Cambridge. So I, weirdly, once I started working there, I lost interest in video games, to be honest. It was
the Dreamcast job.
The Dreamcast burnt me, you know what I mean? Just like, oh, it failed. I'm wasting more money again. But yeah, it was fun working at Game, but they paid well. And so I stuck with that for a bit. And then thankfully, Cineworld had opened up in Cambridge and I got the job of being a projectionist, so I could watch movies for free and preview them and put the films together on 35mm. You know, it was a sort of dream job that didn't pay that well to sort of make it any sort of career. But yeah, once they got rid of like the whole, I was there for like 7 years, and then they made this kind of switch from 35 millimeter projection to digital. And that was kind of the end of projectionists. So once Avatar came out and there went the 3D boom, and they were like, okay, we're going to get rid of all these projectionists. And yeah, we all got kind of laid off. But, you know, I got a good redundancy pay. Then during that period, I was like, what the hell am I going to do? I worked for Jagex for a little bit, you know, in Cambridge. I didn't last long. That's another story. But yeah, so about that time, I was kind of thought, well, I might as well just do this whole YouTube thing, because I'd been watching like other movie critics. Obviously, that guy with the glasses or something, you know, nostalgia critic. There's obviously James Rolfe, you know, reviewing video games. And but I liked the sort of more educational side of things, because I was big into like home format stuff like Laserdisc and DVD. And weirdly, I got into Laserdisc when DVD came out, because everyone was getting rid of their Laserdisc stuff for like peanuts, because they want to jump onto a new format. So I grabbed Laserdisc, got all these discs for you know, little money, and also got into DVD as well, you know. But I was obsessed with all the special features and making ofs and commentaries and Criterion Collection stuff. So that was, I wanted to sort of take some of that and then put it into sort of a video. And weirdly, my first video was on Superman 4, you know, which was, you know, a complete like mess of a movie. And, you know, probably a film Christopher Reeve would, you know, bless him, he's no longer with us, but would obviously want to forget about. But it was, had an interesting production, you know, really fascinating. So that was kind of my first kind of into it. And at the time, you know, it's difficult to sort of get things out. Like I had to sort of share it on different forums and stuff, and then more and more people watched it and asked me to sort of continue doing it. So that essentially became my sort of, well, it took about 3 years to sort of make any money and make it say, hey, I could do this for a living.
What year did you start uploading on YouTube, Banks? I know I'm looking at your channel now, and you registered in 2006. Obviously, that was very early.
Oh, mate, I was doing some awful like trailers, putting them out, and just random clips, and not even caring about copyright. And I did like a weird montage of Caddyshack. I got like, I love Caddyshack, one of the funniest movies. But yeah, I just put all the best bits together and shoved it on YouTube. And then when Harold Ramis died, it just shot up in views. I was like, whoa! But I don't own that video. So, but it was like 2011. I said, okay, well, I'm going to review Superman 4. And it kind of went from there. So everything beforehand is just kind of this weird stuff. Like most people do, if you go on everyone's channel who's been around for a long time, the early stuff just is kind of weird crap. You know,
I'm pleased that YouTube removed that. You know, you could sort them by age before they put that up recently. Yeah, so you can't easily find those first videos
exactly,
now, which as a fellow YouTuber, that's quite a blessing.
So you mentioned that it took a few years for it to kind of take off before it kind of became, you know, a realization of like, oh, I can do this as a job. What was there a particular video that kind of made your channel blow up, or was it kind of like a slow burn, you know, like, you know, every video was kind of getting like a decent amount of traction, or was there like one particular boom, this is great, it's going well now?
It's kind of hard to remember that, Joe, actually. It was just kind of like consistently the views are doing quite well. My channel, weirdly, has always had a slow burn. Like it's always, I'm always getting subscribers, always getting extra views kind of each month. It's never, nothing's ever gone viral. Which kind of is a plus sometimes, and also a bit of a, not really a benefit, because if you do something that goes viral, then people expect that same thing over and over again. And you cannot, because viral is just kind of random often, and you can't really keep up that momentum. So I'd just stuck to what I knew best, and sort of more and more people watch it. And it's funny sometimes when there's a sequel coming out or a remake, people will go look on YouTube looking for the first one or like a review of the original film or the, you know, whatever. And the views just kind of skyrocket. Like Rambo 5 came out and like everyone watched the first of my review on the first movie. So you kind of, and you know, at the time it done okay views, but you see this kind of weird trend where things just jump up. And to figure out what would kind of sort of, you know, saw my channel go up, maybe something like Terminator or Robocop, that often those sort of subjects often have still such a huge following, and people just, you know, always endlessly talk about Terminator franchise or Robocop franchise. And if you kind of cover those and do it well, people will just come piling over to watch it.
And I love the fact that you know, you go really in depth with your analysis as well. And it kind of, what inspired you to take that kind of approach to content creation rather than just being a, you know, some channels just kind of do review stuff and it's quite basic, but you actually, you know, really analyze the movies.
Yeah. I wanted to do something different that was kind of, instead of someone just sitting in front of a camera holding a movie and just talking about it for half an hour, I thought that was thunderously dull. And I liked the edited stuff, and, you know, I wanted to sort of, you know, I liked making trailers and so forth. So I wanted to have have the structurally the reviews have a trailer that I've made, and then it will sort of go into that, you know, how the film was kind of received at the time, and then sort of go into the production side of things just to provide something extra. It wasn't just like, oh, I'm just going to tell you my thoughts on this movie for like 15 minutes and that'll be it. People still do that, people find success with that, but I want to sort of offer something more. And a couple of key things where people were missing was, one, no one talks about the soundtrack to movies, which are extremely important to the success of these films. If you take out the score out of Star Wars, it doesn't work at all. And also the visual effects side of things. But one thing I always enjoyed, because I loved video games, was talking about the licensed games that came out based on these films. Mm. And no one ever explored that in a review. And so it was just trying to grab everything that was available and just put it into one video. And I often throw in like clips from Siskel and Ebert, which everyone hates, you know, because those critics like pan the movie at the time. People are like, oh my God, how do they dare say that? It's like, well, they were watching like 50 movies a week, you know what I mean? And like this movie that came out that we all love, like, I don't know, Never Ending Story or something, they thought was maybe a load of rubbish because they were adults and they were kind of, you know, different mindset. I would always love to include more Barry Norman because he was a little bit more level-headed sometimes. Mm. But the BBC just don't have, you see old clips pop up, people just shoved on YouTube, but just trying to grab something from him to sort of see what he thought at the time was always difficult. Mm. But yeah, so it went from there really. And it was kind of the last chunk was kind of like my critique on it and sort of reflection of the time and my experience with the film. And it's always been, the movies I pick are always something that I experienced when I was younger, generally. I mean, some people just fire out so many requests. I'm like, I don't know that movie. What's it, you know? And people want me to sort of cover it in a very energetic way, perhaps, to something I grew up with. Well, you can't do that. You know, you can't review a movie that perhaps is 30 years old and do it with such enthusiasm for something you'd never seen before, you know. So yeah, that was kind of like my approach to it. And it's all evolved over time, you know. Mm. Things get better, you get better at voiceover. At the beginning, my voiceover was very quiet and kind of monotone in a way, and it takes time in practice. You can't just talk into a microphone and sound good, you know. You have to, it takes time. Like Dan, you know, you've got a very sort of broadcast radio voice when you do this stuff. So it's, you know, it takes a bit of practice, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely a craft that you've got to build up over the years. Yeah, the more you do it, I guess, isn't it? You get used to it.
You get more confident with it, you know. Mm.
So kind of like, how do you think, like, right, I'm going to make a video now on Superman or a video on the Highlander board game? Like, what's your approach? Is it just kind of stuff from your childhood? Like you say, like, you know, you're going to be enthusiastic about it. Like, or is it a case of, you know, RoboCop, there's so much kind of to talk about there. You could talk about the games and stuff as well. Like, do you kind of look at content or do you kind of look at your own experience?
A bit of both. Mm. Joe, it was I don't try and plan ahead too much. Yeah. Some videos are just done on a quick whim, you know, like the Highlander board game. I thought, oh, Highlander, it's movie based, license based, let's play that with Stuart Ashton, he'll love that. And that was kind of a quick thing. And in the case of like RoboCop, I could easily go back and redo those reviews because they're like maybe 6-7 years old now and to sort of expand upon it. So there's always that option. But also there's a new video game coming out. I could review that because it's movie based and it kind of fits with my channel. It gives me quite a bit of variety because there's always movie licensed stuff out there. So you can always cover it and people wouldn't feel it's kind of a weird, different thing. But obviously there's a large percentage of my audience who just want one thing. Mm. A retrospective review on this movie, that movie. If you try and stray away too far, they get a bit upset and no one watches it. But a lot of those kind of things I do on the side are always just for fun. So it's sort of just to keep my mind kind of like fresh and not just get bored of what I do. For example, you mentioned Superman, there's a new 4K release of all the films that came out in the UK. So I reviewed that. That's going to be live like tomorrow.
Yeah.
So there's always something I can just kind of pull out and go, oh, I'm going to review this and at the last minute and do sometimes do a quick turnaround. But also I review new movies as well, which are always kind of a weird one because I think when it comes to new films, I think a lot of people go to certain YouTubers just for that new movie stuff. Where me, it's kind of like, well, not everyone always tunes in. If you're lucky in a way where it's out in the UK before America, it just explodes.
Yeah.
Like I think one of the Terminator sequels was like Dark Fate was out in the UK before America. So everyone just like piled in to hear what I thought. And a lot of the time it's funny stuff like when you do your regular content, you get the regular audience come in. But when you do a new film, you just get the random people come in and they get so upset because you either liked or disliked the movie. So it's just these random people. Like, who is this, you know? So, yeah, that's kind of like – it's fun just having that variety on my channel where I can explore video games and movies.
Well, how do you approach the video game episodes? I mean, you mentioned Terminator there, and that's, you know, what a fantastic video on your channel that you did recently, Terminator video games retrospective. So do you approach them in a similar way to the movies, or is it different?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I do, Dan. I approach them in a very similar way because structurally they're kind of the same. I create a trailer at the beginning that kind of uses voice clips from the movie, but I cut it to the video game. And the video game's got some great – if a video game's got some great cutscenes, I'm like, yes, I can create – something interesting with this. And the Terminator one, well, I first did Robocop and I thought that was kind of interesting to do. People had done videos similar, but they're just showing you footage from each conversion. I'm like, well, that's kind of, it's fine, but it's not, you're not learning anything. And a retro gamer had, you know, covered Robocop and explored some of the conversions where they give you like a bit at the bottom, don't they? Like a little blurb bit telling you which port was on what machine and what the quality was like. So I kind of wanted to take that and kind of expand it into a video and it's always a little bit more difficult when you've got the different ports and trying to provide some information about them. With Terminator, I was kind of lucky where you had a lot about the Sega ports and there's a bit about the Sunsoft version for the Terminator that never came to be, and which is kind of a weird cutscene kind of game, which is just bizarre. And there's quite a bit on the Bethesda version of the very early DOS game. Mm. And so I thought like, well, okay, well, that did extremely well. Just randomly, I didn't know it would do that well. I've also explored Batman conversions as well of the 89 movie, and there's also a lot of information out there from the Ocean staff. Like we've talked about it, like obviously Bill Harbison, you know, who's a great guy. Talking about the artwork for the game, and I'd uncovered stuff he forgot he drew. So that was I think the Atari ST port has like more sort of random cutscenes in the game, and which surprised me because usually the Amiga version was the one everyone sort of favoured. So yeah, it's just kind of fun tapping into that because I had Batman on the C64. I loved it. I thought it was great, even though like every other sprite in the game outside of Batman looked terrible. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was easy. It was so easy to complete. So I was like, oh, a Commodore game I could complete, you know. Most of them were just like impossible to complete the game. But yeah, in the case of Terminator, try and structure it in a way where you can break it down into each port and what you can provide in terms of information. And at the end, just do an overall summary of what you think is kind of the best and worst of these games. And I want to do Terminator 2 because that's a lot of interesting ports as well. But I don't think... outside of the arcade game, most of them are a bit rubbish. Like Ocean's T2 conversions to the Micro Machines and the Amiga were just awful games.
Yeah,
a wasted they might license. Be better forgotten, actually.
Yeah, it's a wasted license.
I mean, I'd be interested in that video, but I'm obsessed with Terminator. So, but yeah, you know when you're like outside of the arcade, there's not many good ones. And I was like, there's the Sega CD one. And I'm like, wait, that's Terminator 1. Yeah.
It's weird, isn't it? It's weird.
My mind went straight away to the original Terminator games. So, but our next question, really interesting one that I've been dying to ask you is, you've interviewed a number of big names, big actors, big filmmakers on your channel over the years. You know, who's been your favourite person to interview and why?
Weirdly, I think Peter MacDonald, who directed Rambo 3.
Okay.
But he's also second unit on, like, all the action movies pretty much for the 80s and 90s, like Tango and Cash and Batman and Robin, weirdly. He was the camera operator on Superman the movie. So I was like, oh, okay, right, I need to talk to him. But Peter is... like he doesn't hold back. He just like constantly swears and is very dry wit, very British man. So it was a joy talking to him about stuff. And he was just very open and kind of doesn't take any sort of rubbish from anyone, especially Van Damme. Cause he worked with Van Damme a lot. And he's just like, well, if you're going to mess around, you know, you're going to be standing around for ages on set.
Yeah.
So but also I interviewed Brad Fidel, you know, the composer of the Terminator scores, who was really interesting, super nice. I remember being there, like I was in London because he came over to visit his daughter who lived in the UK. And he was like, Stan, I was talking to him. And then he suddenly got an email from someone. He looked at it and he goes, oh, another interview request. No, I can't be bothered to do that. I was like, whoa, that could have been me. I felt so lucky to talk to him and about his work. He just wasn't interested in coming back to be a composer. He'd done his thing, but I asked him about Terminator sequels and Terminator 4 and 5. He said he had an interview to come back and score one of the new movies. I think it was Terminator 4. He didn't like the script. He thought it was okay, and they just didn't hear back from him. So the filmmakers were trying to lure him back to do the music, and he just didn't want to. And I said to him, well, you know, with James Horner has sadly passed away, he, of course, did Avatar. I said, as a sort of random thing, if James Cameron had said to you, hey, do you want to do Avatar 2? He was like, no way. He's like, no, I'm not doing that. It's just like, you've got to come back in and learn all the new technology and all the new machines. And it's like, no, you wouldn't do that. But I just, yeah, he was just a really nice guy. So, and I was, throughout the, you know, the course of, in particular, In Search of the Last Action Heroes documentary, where I interviewed quite a lot of the sort of the big names, it was kind of unfortunate in a way where I couldn't be there, so someone else would interview them. So all the questions are kind of mine,
yeah,
and my co-writer Time Sings, but it's just down to sort of the logistics of someone, you know, is the budget there to fly me out to LA to interview this person, where we've already got someone there,
who's got
a camera op base. So yeah, when you look behind it all, it's just like, oh, you know, I could have been there, but you know, budget limitations always puts those things into question.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, I guess you've got to put the budget first, I guess. You know, as amazing as that would be to fly out to LA and, you know, an interview, you know, I'm trying to think of somebody right now, but, you know, it could be a dream come true, but I guess you've got to put the work first and the documentary first, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah. Because essentially, someone who's making a documentary, essentially they're just directing it as kind of a more of a glorified editor, you know. But at the time with that, anyway, it was very much editor. But with my following project, it was very much like, okay, I'm going to direct this because we've got a lot of B-roll to shoot.
Yeah, I can imagine. So, you know, another question kind of relating to that is, how do you kind of get hold of some of these big names? Because you've, you know, some of them not so massive, some of them huge, like Stephen D'Souza, Shane Black, Ronnie Cox. How do you go about getting a hold of these people and, you know, booking in the interviews with them?
Well, in the case of the action documentary I made, we had a guy in America called David Weiner, who was able to sort out through sort of get a few connections, because he had already worked for like a sort of a publisher, like a newspaper, I think. I'm trying to rack my mind of what he did previously. I think he worked for like Fangoria well. Yeah. So you also develop those sort of connections, and he sort of managed to get Shane Black and Paul Verhoeven, and my co-writer Timon Singh, who'd written a book about like action stars who essentially played the bad guys. His book was called Born to Be Bad. And he'd already interviewed a bunch of people, so he had all these connections, and just like, okay, well, time you've interviewed them before, you can just do it again, you know, and also with the questions we've kind of formulated. So that was kind of a bit very straightforward. But other ways you have to sort of go through, I mean, sometimes you just go through IMDb Pro.
Yeah.
It costs a lot of money. It's like £150 a year. And if you forget to cancel your subscription, there's a bit of a shock when you see your bill. It's like, what the hell? So where's this come? Where's my money gone? But yeah, it will have their agents on there or PA or whatever. And you can reach them that way. Oh. You know, some interviewees want to be paid, some don't, but it's also often a kind gesture to pay them a little bit of money, just for their time. And, you know, and in the case of Stephen D'Souza, he's just like, it was such an easy thing because he's always willing to have a chat about his work, and he's a lovely guy. Mm. And, you know, he could just talk like a machine about Street Fighter and what he's done. And which makes it a little bit difficult to edit. He talks quite fast. If you have two camera set up, you're fine, but we didn't. but yeah, he was, you know, so he's trying to, also when you interview people who've talked about movies or their work over and over again, they often repeat their same story. So you've got to, if you're going to make something new, you've got to try and break them away from that traditional kind of narrative they deliver. So you have to sort of ask questions that aren't really asked of them before. So I knew that with some of the people I was going to interview. So I sort of like, okay, right, well, let's chat about this. We haven't chat about that before, like Street Fighter, for example. Let's talk about the LaserDisc that came out. Let's talk about the music videos, the soundtrack, not just like, oh, Van Damme was having problems and Raul Julia was kind of suffering from cancer. Those stories are vital, but you want to sort of, you know, get the interviewee to sort of explore something else.
You know, kind of going beyond your YouTube channel, I mean, you know, over the last few years, you've made some really in-depth documentary films. I mean, I'm sure a lot of our audience have seen In Search of the Last Action Heroes. So how do you go from making, you know, YouTube videos to these full-on documentaries that, you know, released on services like Amazon Prime? How did you make that move?
Well, it was I had real no, I didn't have a notion of sort of making a documentary, like feature length or anything that would be officially released. But a guy called Robin Block, who now runs sort of Creator VC, who later produced like In Search of Darkness and In Search of Tomorrow. He'd come from that sort of TV world, and he was a patron of mine. And he said, and I made the Superman 4 documentary about the shooting locations and how they use Milton Keynes for Metropolis and stuff. And my friend Tim Partridge, who I'd known for years, and we were both kind of knowledgeable about the films. And Tim had directed it, and I'd sort of written it with him. And that really impressed Robin because it was very TV-like. It felt like a TV program, right? Well, on YouTube, it's difficult to find stuff that is often of TV quality. Obviously, now I think camera equipment's getting better and better and cheaper, and so people can shoot stuff in 4K and it'll look great, but it's not really TV. Mm. It's more of just a sort of, this looks good. So Robin has seen that and said, hey, look, I've got this TV experience. Let's make a documentary. What would you like to make it on? And I was like, oh, I don't know. We sort of looked at what was popular on my channel, and it was mostly action movies. So we said, let's make a documentary about 80s action and 90s action, right? Originally, Robin was just like, just focus on 80s. I was like, well, no, because I want to see it progress because the 90s still had great movies. So we thought of the idea of like, okay, let's crowdfund this. I've never done crowdfunding before, didn't know how it worked. So Robin sort of handled that, and I sort of just pushed out the PR for it, and it did very well. Mm. And so we sort of went from that, gave us the budget, gave us the, and obviously Time and Sing came on board, you know, that's, everything sort of slotted into place. And it's sort of, and originally we had one editor on board, fantastic guy, but he just wasn't kind of, it wasn't his thing, the action genre. So I took it off his hands and I kind of re-edited it with a colleague of mine, and we sort of reshaped it. And we wanted it to be very much like Electric Boogaloo, like the Canon Films documentary, which was like,
yeah,
a great celebration of that 80s kind of like high of them finding success through like Break-In and like Van Damme movies, Chuck Norris movies, then collapsing because they spent too much money making He-Man the movie, you know. So yeah, I wanted to have that same energy, and we sort of kind of captured that with the actual one, I felt. So once that was sort of came out, we'd spoke with distributors, and Robin had sort of arranged with Gravitas Ventures to sort of sell it to them. So I don't own it, you know. I won't own it for another. It's a weird deal. They got it for like 15 years. They own it or something like that. Right. So it's kind of, that's how it. Yeah, they Gravitas take a huge chunk of the ownership. So they sort of like. Obviously, it's an American company, and then they sort of sold it onto other platforms. So that's why it's on Amazon, and you can find it on, you know, other streaming platforms around the world. But I don't make any money off it. You know, it was a shame. But yeah, that was a lot of fun making that. It did well. It got good reviews, and that sort of gave me the confidence to go out on my own to make my next documentary. Because once you've sort of gone through the process of making these things, it's kind of straightforward in that way. It's still a challenge though, being, you know, trying to advertise a crowdfunding kind of production, because you still have to have that skill set of being good at marketing. And it's, yeah, again, it's not something I'm that highly skilled in, and it's, you know, requires specialists to do that. So it's always that's always a challenge, I think, with YouTubers, where they're one thing where they're good at critiquing stuff, but then you step out in the kind of the real world where you've got to sort of sell something or try and promote something in a very sort of, you know, in an effective way. It requires a lot more talent there to sort of, you know, to get it pushed forward. So yeah, I had, you know, with the Street Fighter 2 documentary, Here Comes a New Challenger, it's very much like I surrounded myself with filmmakers who were very talented to sort of cushion the blow. So I wasn't doing everything, but ultimately I kind of ended up doing a lot more work than I originally intended.
Well, let's talk about the new film then, because I mean, both Joe and I have watched it and absolutely loved it. And anyone that loves Street Fighter 2 is going to really enjoy this movie. I mean, it's over, what, nearly 2.5 hours long. It's a real love letter to Street Fighter 2. So kind of give us the lowdown and the background on this, and what can viewers expect from it?
Well, the sort of the background of it all was, during the course of making the action documentary, I was editing the sort of section on the Street Fighter movie, because obviously it's about Van Damme, and Steven D'Souza's talking about his experience with it. And I thought, wait a minute, it would be great to make a documentary about Street Fighter 2 and focus on that early 90s period. And once I finished the, you know, In Search of the Last Action Heroes, I thought, okay, let's try and focus on this Street Fighter thing. What's kind of missing out there that people need to know? Or, you know, because I'd you know, fellow YouTubers, you know, have covered Street Fighter 2, either just as the game or like the movie or whatever. And I think Capcom had also commissioned a documentary as well a number of years ago. I think it's called I Am Street Fighter or something like that. And it was really focused on the tournament aspect and all the pro gamers, which is also an important part of Street Fighter's history. But it didn't speak to me at all. Like, I didn't know anyone like in the 90s who was a pro gamer who went to tournaments. It was very niche. And so I thought, well, okay, well, what was my experience with Street Fighter? So it was all about, like, you know, playing the arcade, like either like a Laser Quest or like a fair that will come to your town. You had like reading the magazines about it, experienced the, you know, the game on the Super Nintendo. Obviously, then the merchandise came out. It was all that kind of that 91 to 95 period was really all Street Fighter. You know, every magazine covered it. If it wasn't on the cover, then why wasn't it? You know what I mean? Like, I think Julian Rignall sort of said, like, it was always used to promote the magazine because it does sell issues. So let's try, I thought to myself, let's try and capture that sort of moment in time and see if, like, you know, because I pitched the idea to other people who also had a similar love for Street Fighter 2, and they're like, yeah, this is great because this is actually what I remember. So in the course of the documentary, like, you know, I made sure I covered the magazines, I made sure I covered the player's guide videotape, even the books, obviously the G.I. Joe merchandise that was kind of revamped to be Street Fighter, everything kind of just around the video game as well. That was important to me, that what surrounded Street Fighter 2, the game, and to sort of make it sort of continue its like longevity over these years. Because I remember, you know, come like Super Street Fighter 2, everyone was like, oh, there's four new characters. Oh, cool, cool, cool. And then you play it, and the game's really slow. And like, and it was super expensive as well on the Mega Drive, like 60 quid my friend paid for it. And that was also another kind of thing I wanted to talk about, was like, what if video game magazines were promoting these things, giving it high scores, but also maybe understanding that there was a lot of kids, you know, reading these magazines who didn't have a lot of money. Did they feel somewhat guilty and sort of kind of promoting this game was like £60 and their parents then got to buy it, you know? I remember the guilt of trying to persuade my mum to buy Super Street Fighter 2 on the SNES for £50. And they'd say, oh, it's got four new characters. I'm like, don't you own Street Fighter 2? I'm like, yes, I do, but it's slightly newer.
There's four, you know, new ones.
Yeah. Who I didn't really play as anyway. I just played as Ken so we can do his Flaming Dragon Punch.
Yeah.
It's like, no. I paid 50 quid for a Flaming Dragon Punch, you know?
Nobody played as Cammy in T-Hawk.
No, not really. So, yeah, so all of those sort of, you know, fond memories and nostalgia, what I just wanted to sort of really replicate in this documentary and also provide this kind of timeline of events that would sort of tap into everyone's sort of nostalgia and not feel somewhat isolated by it. Therefore, like, I remember that. I played that, you know. I remember the sort of frustrating, you know, trying to, you know, buy these games, but I didn't have the money, and, you know, maybe, you know, sort of hyped by the movie and then being hugely disappointed, or pretending you liked it but you really hated it, you know. So that hopefully that was all kind of, you know, what you saw of it, you know. Yeah. Recently that was kind of replicated in the documentary.
So who features in the documentary, and also did Capcom kind of have any involvement in it at all? Did you kind of have to reach out to Capcom with it all?
No, we didn't involve Capcom because it was, you know, documentaries, you know, you can make anything on a documentary and not have to ask people's permission.
Yeah.
You have to sort of go for the legal hurdles of fair use to make sure you are using things accordingly. So, you know, we've got interviews with, like, obviously Paul Davis, who worked for CVG, ex-editor of the, you know, the great magazine. I always kind of knew of Paul. Obviously Julian Jazz Rignall, you know, everyone knew Julian. Obviously as a kid, I was, you know, he's obviously read the Nintendo magazine system, and obviously seeing on Games Master with his incredible mullet, you know, I think only he and Nick Kershaw could probably pull it off. And obviously got Steven D'Souza, you know, director of the movie. We've got Damian McFarren, obviously contemporary critic, works Nintendo Life and Time Extension. Also Yoshiki Okamoto, the producer of Street Fighter 2, which was a real win because that was really difficult to get hold of him to sort of do it. Because after the interview, I think I recall him saying, you know, he rarely talks about, really gives interviews about Street Fighter 2, so we're apparently quite lucky, which was nice, you know. We also got the composer of the video game as well. She was an absolute delight. You know, she felt so happy afterwards, you know, sort of talking about the music and being asked questions she hadn't been asked before. And obviously Skip Skellerack did the voice of Ryu from the animated movie. Ryan Hart, obviously a pro gamer, a really fascinating guy, very funny. And because I'd seen, you know, some of the other pro gamers talk in a previous documentary, but they seemed a little bit bored and a bit like not really enthusiastic and energetic when they were talking. So, which is kind of, you know, normal because how people act, you know. And I had a friend who did this, you know, big Xbox event years ago, and he had to interview all these pro gamers, and he goes, God, they're all so boring. It was like it took him a nightmare to edit this down, these all these interview clips. And but that's kind of what people are. I mean, pro gamers aren't supposed to be sort of, you know, charismatic in a way. But yeah, Ryan was just like a great laugh. And we had, you know, two guys from Digital Foundry, John Linneman and Audie Surley. Audie was really vital behind the scenes because he had, you know, had contacts with the Japanese crew. And so, yeah, he was, you know, an absolute joy to sort of interview and sort of work with. Obviously, one of my favorites was obviously Jeff Walker, who had, worked for Capcom USA, sort of the arcade department, helped develop Champion Edition with James Goddard, who, you know, worked on Champion and Hybrid Fighting. James was like, when I interviewed him, he said, like, am I going to be in this thing for like 2 minutes? Because he's done so many interviews in the past where you get interviewed for like 2 hours and you find yourself for barely any time, any screen time. Mm-hmm. So don't worry, James, you'll be fine. And he is, and he's in it loads. And and I love that guy. And obviously, sadly, you know, I think I was maybe the last person to interview Mick McGinty, who did the artwork for the US releases of Street Fighter 2. And he was an incredible storyteller, and I loved his voice, you know. And you know, he sadly passed away shortly after the interview, and I was shocked by that. Absolutely shocked, because he seemed normal. He seemed really healthy. I'm just like, well, you just don't know sometimes. And he was just a joy to interview. So yeah, it was a bit of a challenge at first trying to get people to commit to be interviewed, because not everyone wants to be interviewed on camera, because people are either burned by the past, or they've talked about it too much, or they just don't want to be on camera. So I had to go through the sort of tick boxes of who would want to take part and stuff. And I kept the talking heads, like the number of interviewees, down to like, I think like 14, 15 people. And once you get too many interviewees, it just becomes a nightmare to juggle everyone and give them enough screen time, because someone's going to dedicate 2 or 3 hours to be interviewed, and you're going to use them for a minute. I always felt insulting, you know, for their time. So I always try and give everyone enough screen time, you know, and make sure their points are across. Obviously, you know, it may be down to you could interview some people and they just don't have, they just can't remember certain things. But most people were just like on the game, you know, they knew what they're talking about. They remembered everything so vividly. And so that was really helpful for me. And, you know, if you can get a great interview in like half an hour, 45 minutes, it's a joy, because you don't want to be sitting there for 3 hours of ums and ahs with people trying to remember stuff. It's not fun to edit, but
the less editing, the better, isn't it?
exactly. Yeah. So yeah.
Well, Street Fighter 2, I mean, that's often credited. I mean, I remember when that first came out back in the early 90s in the arcades. I mean, a lot of people said that rejuvenated the arcade scene. I mean, what kind of factors do you think contributed to its success in the arcades, and what kind of your memories of seeing it in the arcades?
I think to its success, it was very much down to how it played. You know, a fighting game where you had special moves, you had combos, you had characters that were all colorful from, like, all set around from around the world. It played so differently to every other fighting game you'd seen before, which felt so stiff and like you couldn't do combos. So, you know, like before that, you know, you also had Street Fighter 1, which was kind of moderate success. And you had other sort of competitors to it. But yeah, I suppose even at the same time, with Street Fighter 2 being developed, you had Fatal Fury in the background, which kind of played more like Street Fighter 1, but it still had it was still great to look at and play. But like, obviously, prior to Street Fighter 2, we had Final Fight, which kind of gave you that sort of combo sort of combat, and it still had some big, colorful characters. My experience with Street Fighter 2 was very much, I'd heard it through a friend at primary school. It sounded amazing. And then the fair, well, you know, for the Americans, it's the carnival, you know, sort of turned up to my local village, because I lived in a town just outside Cambridge. And so I didn't really, you know, I didn't live in London. I couldn't go down to all the, you know, the arcades they had there. So seeing Street Fighter 2 for the first time was amazing, you know, because I'd only heard about it, or maybe seen pictures in magazines, like Mii Machines or something like that. But then also, you know, very quickly afterwards, because things kind of spread out slowly, right? The game was released in 91, but I think majority of the people around the world may have not experienced it till later part of that year or early 92. So when that time, there were talks about the Super Nintendo version, you know, of Street Fighter 2 coming exclusively to the Super Nintendo. And then you see the early screenshots, and then you saw the price of it. Like, I knew, I spoke to Paul Davis about it because he paid £100 for it on import. Every person I knew who was similar age to me, or maybe a bit older, who had a bit of money, spent over £100 on Street Fighter 2 for their, and then also buying an import device to play the Japanese version on your UK SNES. You know, so it was a lot of money to people was that obsessed with it. They were willing to spend maybe over £100 on it, which was in 92. That's a lot of money. So it was, to properly play it, like I could enjoy it at home, was to rent it. And that was on the Mega Drive. That was a Champion Edition, sort of turbo port. That's like 93. But also prior to that, I mentioned earlier, the Commodore 64 version, which was like, came out, I think roughly the same time as the SNES one. Because US Gold obviously got the rights, and now we're going to put it out for Christmas of 90, was it 92? Was it 93? I can't remember now. But yeah, so that was my experience with it. And my friends had it on the Amiga. And yeah, I unfortunately had the worst port of Street Fighter 2.
So it's funny. So I loved that there's like a whole section in the documentary, like the first 20 minutes is kind of dedicated to Street Fighter 1. You know, Street Fighter 1 doesn't get a lot of love. You know, Street Fighter 2 is kind of like the world phenomenon. But if you're anything like me, it wasn't until I was an adult and kind of heard about Street Fighter 1, I never really thought about it, you know, that there was an original, that there was a first one.
Yeah.
Were you familiar with Street Fighter 1, the game, before Street Fighter 2 at all?
Not at all. Not at all. It was so weird. Like, oh, what's this game, Street Fighter 2? And then you just didn't think about a first one.
Yeah.
You know, and then I got the player's guide. That was advertised in all the magazines. It was the Game Pro guide that was sort of put out in the UK to change the cover or something like that. And in there, it gave like a timeline of things, and it said Fighting Street on the PC Engine. I went, what? Or Turbo Graphics. I thought, why is it called Fighting Street? You know, but that was Street Fighter 1 in my eyes at the time. And I didn't really play it to emulation. I thought, oh, okay, this is why they don't talk about Street Fighter 1 anymore. I didn't know any friends who had it, because I had a Commodore, obviously, and I think I tried to get Street Fighter 1, because the cover, the advertising US Gold did was amazing. Like it looked like the Warriors, you know, like the covers they did. It didn't look like Street Fighter at all, because for the US artwork was so different. And I just couldn't get it, because all these magazines I got, like Commodore format, I think they were old copies, and these companies all gone defunct, and you couldn't buy it anymore. And so my friend in Amiga also didn't have it either. So I had no experience of it to emulation. And it wasn't great to play. But there is, actually, people have done really good remakes of it, like on those Mugen engines where they've, I think some 10 years ago, the Street Fighter 1 remastered. And it's so good. You can be like a guy from Final Fight in there. You've got combos, you've got super moves. I was playing it the other day. I was like, wow. This is really good. Well, I should redo that. Obviously, as we, through time went on, we had Street Fighter Alpha 1, 2, and 3, which essentially are kind of like updates to Street Fighter 1.
Prequels and stuff, aren't they? Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah. But I made sure to cover enough for Street Fighter 1 in the documentary because I didn't want it to be just a wishy-washy kind of like 5 minutes.
It's
not very good, gone. I wanted to sort of really get people to talk about it.
One thing I love that you covered as well is, you know, those bootleg versions of Street Fighter 2 in the arcades. They were quite prevalent at the time as well. I mean, give us a bit of insight into those and why that happened.
Yeah, that was interesting because, you know, in the documentary, Jeff Walker had to deal with all the bootlegs because the Rainbow Edition came out, which was obviously a modded version of Champion Edition, which lets you, you know, if you play as Ryu, you can do like constant fireballs going up and down the screen, Sonic Booms going up and down. You can teleport, you can change character. It was completely broken, but it was super fast. That's why people loved it. And so they also had to combat that by sort of finding out who did this. And they kind of like, well, I won't reveal it because it'll be a surprise in the documentary, but they tried to stop it being distributed throughout the world. And it obviously didn't, because a lot of it got out because we'd all played it, you know, even at like a pub or a chippy, you know, in my youth club at school, we had a Rainbow Edition of Street Fighter 2. And I was so annoyed because they took out, I remember I used to go there when I was younger. They took out the World Warrior and Mortal Kombat, which were both fine. They weren't bootlegs or whatever. Then I just dumped a rainbow edition of Street Fighter 2. I'm like, that was a bit annoying. But you could, if you're a Ryu, though, you could complete it in about 5-10 minutes,
yeah.
Speed through it by doing constant fireballs. But yeah, so to combat that, they had to develop hyper fighting, you know, to sort of get rid of that off the market, to make people buy into another version of Street Fighter 2. At the same time, they were developing Super, and they're also reluctant to make another, you know, sort of update to Street Fighter 2 without introducing new characters. So, but yeah, they were reluctant, but it was really successful, hyper fighting, and that sort of made everyone forget about Rainbow Edition. But I think there's so many mods of that Champion Edition, because even if you try to find the right version people are talking about, it took me a night. It was a nightmare trying to find the right version of Rainbow Edition, because everyone had done their own mods.
Yeah, yeah.
Like over the years, I'm like, oh, this is not the version I played. You know, even the logo was different. Like it should be how it should be, like a rainbow color design.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was a nightmare trying to find that. And weirdly, like because we shot all the interviews at 24 frames per second. Gameplay, it varies in its frame rates, doesn't it? It goes from like 30 to 60. Mm. So I shot in advance. I went, oh, okay, I'm going to be really smart here and capture everything at 60 frames per second. If you drop 60 frames per second of gameplay into 24 frames per second timeline, it's awful. It's so juddery. Mm. It's like, oh, what am I going to do? And my friend said, oh, just Ollie, just, you know, capture at 48 frames per second. Once you half that, that's 24. It's still fine. It looks great. I was like, yay. But I had to do a lot more gameplay. But I got better again at Street Fighter 2, thankfully.
So Street Fighter 2, the animated movie, is a real fan favorite. In your opinion, what made the adaptation work so well and stay true to the video game?
Because it's got special moves, it's got swearing in it, it's got nudity. No, I'm joking. I think because it focused on the characters, it focused on focused on Ryu and Ken.
Yeah.
Mainly Ryu. And that's what people loved. And I think that was really the storyline in everyone's minds was about Ryu, you know. So like in the case of the movie where it had to be Van Damme and obviously Guile because he's American, just for marketing purposes, I think, really, and to sell it worldwide, which I completely understand. But the anime, it was very much like, it felt like the game. It looked like the game and it sounded like the game. And I just loved the UK dub, you know, and you go back and listen to the Japanese one, who people are fans of that style, the music and the original voices with subtitles. I was like, no. I love the UK one because it's got loads of swearing in it. It's got the like grunge music. It's got Korn, Silverchair, Alice in Chains. It's nuts. And that's what, and at 15 years old, you know, when that came out on VHS, it was just like, oh, this is Street Fighter for me, you know, at that age. It had all the violence. It had a bit of nudity and, you know, foul language. And it just had the attitude. And that's the attitude of Street Fighter you kind of wanted. What the movie was missing. And it's kind of weird in a way because like the anime kind of came first before the live action movie, but in the documentary kind of it's more of a Western perspective. So you have to sort of follow those timelines. So it's kind of the movie and then the anime. And the anime came out in the UK in like October of 95, which I still remember buying from like W.H. Smith, I think, or Woolworths, good old Woolworths. And in America, it didn't come out till 96. On VHS. It's weird. It's massive delays and stuff. But I mean, the anime sort of nailed it. And I don't think they ever nailed it again in terms of anime for Street Fighter. I know there's like TV shows they did. And I did an Alpha movie. But yeah, that one just really clicked at the time. And I think that's what people are still really fond of that period.
I mean, over the years, in terms of Street Fighter II, the game, I mean, there's been so many re-releases and compilations and upgrades. And, you know, if I think about there's probably a few video games that I brought on pretty much every platform for the last 30 years. You know, Sonic 2 would be one of them. I probably bought that about 20 times. Street Fighter 2 would be the other one. It's just, you know, every generation, it ends up getting repackaged.
Yeah.
I mean, why do you think the game continues to resonate with gamers today, like even 30 years later?
I think it's just down to it. It's very easy to play. You know the moves. You know the combos. It's not complicated like Street Fighter 5 or, you know, even number 6 is coming out soon. But if you say look at Street Fighter 4 and 5, we had these kind of different meters and stuff to it all. It made it a little bit more like, you know, as someone who hasn't played it for a while, it's slightly intimidating. So going back to what you know is people a lot more fond of. And that's why kind of when you review movies in my channel, when you cover a film that everyone's kind of familiar with, it's like, it's comfort food. And if you do something different or something slightly niche, they're like, oh, I don't know if I should watch this because I've never heard of it, whatever. But that's what people often become a little bit like, just don't try anything new, but you have to sort of play the game of like giving people what they want sometimes. And Capcom see that there's still a market for it. And for every console release, there's going to be a Street Fighter collection. You know, which one's the best? I don't know. But I still really love like Capcom Generation 5 that was on the Saturn and PlayStation. Well, it's kind of called Street Fighter Collection 2 for the PlayStation in the West, but it had like, if you complete the game, it's got World Warrior, Champion, and Turbo. And once you completed it, you unlock the remix music. And it's the 3DO music. And I was like, oh my God, the 3DO Super Turbo music was incredible. So that was kind of my favorite version. But I spoke to Stephen Frost, you know, in the documentary, who's, again, really knowledgeable, was a you know, a critic beforehand, you know, before he jumped into the world of sort of video games and developing them. Because he worked on the Anniversary Collection for the 35th. So it was like a... he'd wanted to include a lot more stuff on it, like the console ports, the Rainbow Edition, the movie, video game, but trying to get clearance for the arcade edition of Street Fighter 2, the movie one.
Yeah.
It'd be a nightmare. There's been no port of it, has there?
There's two versions of it as well, isn't there? The arcade game and the home console are actually different games, aren't they? So that would have been really cool to see.
Oh, definitely, because everyone still kind of... no one's really fond of those movie games, right? But people like the console version because it plays like Super Turbo, but I'm like, no. I love the arcade one because the animation's so slick, but it's so nuts and bonkers and just like so quick. You just don't know what it doesn't really play like Street Fighter 2 in a traditional sense, but I just love its kind of swagger and kind of like just the animation style. And it's never, that version's never been officially ported.
So how can people watch the documentary and what's the reaction been like so far?
Well, reaction, you know, from the premiere we had, everyone absolutely loved it, which was a big relief because, you know, we'd only shown it to, well, any of the production team had seen it. And obviously we've seen it over and over and over again. So you sort of become a bit snowblind to stuff or just like, does this work? I don't know. And then once we premiered it, everyone was like, wow, this is amazing. And, you know, as you say, very early on, it's very comprehensive. And I think the only criticism I could say so far was like, it perhaps maybe a little bit too long for the casual gamer. But I, you know, I had an obligation and something I wanted to do to sort of make sure I covered everything and give everything a sort of fair amount of time throughout. Cause I don't like watching documentaries where you're waiting for the bit you want to hear about and it's like a minute. And it's like, oh, great, you know. So I dedicate enough time to like the micro ports and the magazine coverage and even like the movie game. So it wasn't just forgotten about. We're also taking pre-orders at the moment for the Blu-ray. The backers who helped fund it, because this was a crowdfunded production, we're getting their copies digital and Blu-rays in the next coming weeks. And so we're hoping to sort of ship everything out in May. And then, it should be hopefully in the next couple of weeks, couple of months, there will be a digital copy. So if you want to get it on Blu-ray, it's got extra special features. It's region free. You can get it now. And obviously it'll be sent out in May. I'm kind of excited to let more people see it because, you know, it's, you know, reviews so far, people that have screened it have all been, you know, extremely positive, which is great. I'm just kind of hoping, you know, the fan base who really love Street Fighter and obsess over it, find something new in there or just find, they can see it and really connect to it and not feel left out in a way like some of the previous ones and find something that really connects with them. So fingers crossed it sort of plays out in my favour.
Yeah, Oliver, it's, you know, like I said, Joe and I have both watched it. The presentation's fantastic. You go so in depth as well. And it's just, yeah, for anyone that loves Street Fighter, you know, it's an essential watch. So I'll obviously link up your website where people can order the Blu-ray in our show notes as well.
Thank you.
You've been, I imagine, you know, deep in this for the last couple of years. I mean, anything kind of on the pipeline? Are you kind of thinking about what your future projects might be?
Oh, God, I'm having a break, mate. Yeah.
Well deserved.
Because it's been a long process. It's been a fun process as well. It's taken longer than I expected, but you know, we had to battle COVID as well, you know, people's availability. Yeah. I mean, we shot this on a limited budget, but you know, the camera operators and crew made it look like $1 million. You know, it's like the B-roll stuff they shot was just amazing. So I think after this, you know, I have been developing another documentary, which may be on the Superman films, but we'll see how that plays out. But I've been enlisted to edit a feature film, an action movie called The Last Kumite, which is kind of a throwback to Bloodsport and Kickboxer. So this is, that's kind of the, you know, the, like, a couple of days left of crowdfunding that production. And they've got some great B-movie stars in it, like Cynthia Rothrock, Mateus Hughes. You've got Kurt McKinney from No Retreat, No Surrender. You've got the bad guys from, like, Bloodsport and Lionheart. So, yeah, it's really cool cast. And it's like on editing a proper feature film, not like a documentary, but something with, you know, drama, acting and action in it, which is going to be really exciting. So they're going to be shooting that in June, I believe. So maybe July I'll be having to edit that movie and the stress that comes with that. You know? So, yeah, I'm not really having a break, really. I should really have a break because I'm shattered all the time.
Oh, it sounds like you're loving it, though.
Yeah. You complain, awesome, but yeah, you do love it, so...
Yeah. And obviously, you know, you're releasing new YouTube videos all the time as well. So, I mean, you know, for anyone that hasn't seen your channel yet, I'll put a link to your channel in the show notes too. So
thank you very much.
Yeah. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Good luck with the movie. And thanks so much for reminiscing with us over the last hour.
Thank you very much for having me on. It's been a pleasure chatting with you guys. It's, you know, I love your podcast. So it's great to be on it.